course we offer is Basics, a six-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterton at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterton, the voice for mental health in Hunterton County.
Good morning, Hunterton. This is Big C coming to you from HuntertonChamberRadio.com at the studio offices of the Hunterton County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Good morning, Hunterton kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Hunterton County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Hunterton, HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
Hey, this is Big C of Good Morning Hunterton on HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Like what you hear on Hunterton Chamber Radio? Now you can take it with you. Download our Hunterton Chamber Radio app from iTunes and Google Play Store now. Get schedules, station information, listen live, or to the latest podcasts. Everything in the palm of your hand or in your car during your commute. Get the HuntertonChamberRadio.com app today.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann Disatel, celebrant officiant with Celebration of a Lifetime. When people ask me why I joined the Chamber, it's because I want to get to know you and what you're all about. And I want you to get to know me and what I'm all about. And together, I'd like to celebrate what we can do for Hunterton County.
Hunterton Chamber of Commerce. Building business. One business at a time.
The weather this afternoon is going to be slightly sunny with a high near 88. Con winds. Every time you look out, it's either sun or it's clouds, so I can't tell which. Tonight will be mostly clear. Low around 61 with calm winds. Tuesday, sunny with a high near 86. Calm winds between 5 and 7 miles an hour in the afternoon. Tuesday night will be a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly after 2 a.m. It'll be mostly cloudy with a low around 68. Light south winds. And the chance of precipitation is 30%. Wednesday, there's a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Be mostly cloudy with a high near 87. South winds, 3 to 8 miles an hour. And the chance of precipitation is 40%. About a tenth to a quarter of an inch of rainfall, if possibly higher with thunderstorms. Wednesday night, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy with a low around 73. Thursday, you got a chance of showers and thunderstorms. It'll be partly sunny with a high near 90, and a chance of precipitation is 30%. Well, I hope it's nice on Thursday because my kids are taking me to the Met game, so I hope it's nice. Thursday night is supposed to be mostly cloudy with a low around 72. Welcome to Mental Health Matters. This is the Hunterton County Chamber of Commerce's hour, which is NAMI's hour, through courtesy of the Chamber of Commerce. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and there is a chapter of NAMI in every county in the state of New Jersey, every state in the union, and overseas. In Hunterton County, we are all volunteers. We have no office, no paid staff, and we work out of our houses. And we try to help people who either have someone in their family with a mental health issue or someone themselves who have a mental health issue. And we do it through various means. We have classes we teach. We have a 12-week course called Family to Family, which is for families who either have someone or know someone or work with someone who has a mental health issue. We run support groups. We have what they call a basics course, which is a six-week course for families who have younger children, 17 below, below 18 actually, and it could get down to, you know, 3-4 years old. Everything we do is free of charge. There is no cost. We don't charge for materials. We don't charge for anything. And if you need to get a hold of us or would like to get a hold of us and get some more information about mental health and what we do and don't do and what we can do or help you with, you can reach us by calling 908-284-0500. That's 908-284-0500. And today we are very privileged to have with us Dr. Marla Deibler, who is a licensed clinical psychologist, and she's the founder and executive director of the Center for Emotional Health of Greater Philadelphia, which is located in Cherry Hill and also in Princeton, New Jersey. Dr. Deibler has been on Dr. Oz and on A&E Hoarders, CBS, ABC, Fox News, has had articles in the New York Times and other major papers, so I am always honored to have Dr. Marla on the show with us. Doctor, can you hear me?
I can. Thanks so much for having me, Larry.
Well, it's really a privilege and a pleasure because you do so much good, and I just think that it's wonderful. And, you know, I have to ask you, because I ask a lot of people, well, I ask most everybody this, and I may have asked you this before, I just don't quite remember. I ask people how they got into this type of work, and sometimes people say, well, I was out of work and needed a job, you know, yada, yada, and this came along, which is basically what I say when people ask me how I got into what I was doing. And other people say, well, you know, something happened in the family and when I was younger and I always wanted to do this. So I was just curious, how did you become, you know, into this line of work?
Well, I was always interested in healthcare. My mother was a nurse, and it was really a great part of her identity as a person and as a mom, too. So I was always interested in healthcare, and when I went away to college, was looking into being perhaps pre-med and become a physician. But when I went away to college, which was quite early, I was about 900 miles from home, and I was 16, I began to have some trouble with anxiety. And it became quite intense and was pretty impairing. And I was quite amazed at the power that the mind has over the body and how something seemingly so innocuous could really have a great deal of effect on your life. So I got really effective treatment, and I got very interested in mental health.
That's interesting. I find it, like I said, I find it very interesting how different people got into different lines of work, you know. I was one of the ones who had a house, mortgage, 4 kids, car payments, taxes, and I needed a job, you know. and Wounded Bread hired me, so, so that's how I got into Wounded Bread, and how I got into I was like their transportation manager for, you know, a few plants from on the East Coast. And at that time, it was only for tractor trailer drivers, not the little trucks who deliver the bread every day, but the tractor trailers who haul it, you know, from one point to another. And at that time, everybody was using paper logs. So what part of my job was to make sure all the logs were accurate in case the state, whatever state they were in, would come to investigate them, you know, or do a survey of them and so on and so forth. And, you know, I would hire drivers by giving them road tests and stuff like that. But it was just, you know, like I said, I needed a job at the time, and that's how I got into my line of work, and I was there for a good many years. Anyway, getting back to our subject, thank you for sharing that, because I was just curious how you, you know, got into your line of work.
Sure. I come by it honestly. Well,
you know, with your background from what you mentioned, it sort of, I don't know, it gives you like an inside into helping others who are going through anxiety and some other problems because you've been there.
Yeah, I feel like it does. I think that having had difficulties in the past can certainly negatively impact one's ability to help. But I feel like if you've successfully dealt with some of this yourself, then, you know, having that as part of your background experience allows you to be more empathic and understanding of how it's currently affecting the person that you're sitting with.
Right. Exactly. Last week I had Dr. Ron from Long Island, who's been on a couple times, and she's written books and, you know, and so on and so forth, and she has a clientele. And she also has suffered from depression. She's been hospitalized twice. She was attempted suicide once and was stopped before it, you know, took effect. And so when she's talking to, like I said to her, when she's talking to her clients, just as I'm saying to you, you're speaking from experience. It's like someone, like you've walked the walk and talked the talk. It's not like, you know, you're, and I'm not saying that there's not good doctors who haven't suffered some sort of a mental health issue, because there are, but it just seems to me that when someone like you and this doctor I had on last week, you're more into it because you understand it a little better?
It's definitely a different perspective. I don't often bring it up in sessions with clients because it really, you know, is about them and their situation and how to best understand them. But I feel like it does, you know, come across in the way that I interact with them.
Right, right. And yeah, I wouldn't expect you to bring it up to everybody that you speak to, but you know, it's just from a off the record type of thing. You know, I think it's awesome. Your centers, you specialize in anxiety disorders and obsessive compulsive disorder, and I would assume a numerous number of related disorders. Would you take us through these and the symptoms?
Absolutely. We treat a few different families of disorders. We treat anxiety disorders, which range from things like generalized anxiety, which is when people have difficulties with controlling worries about a lot of different things in their life, and it begins to negatively impact their functioning, to things like specific phobias, when someone is afraid of something very specific, and that negatively impacts their life, to things like panic disorder, which is when people have discrete periods of anxiety, which we call panic attacks,
mm-hmm.
To other things related to it, like obsessive compulsive and related disorders, which is another family of disorders, like obsessive compulsive disorder, which involves anxiety related to intrusive thoughts or images, feelings that then create a great deal of distress or anxiety, and people respond to that distress by carrying out either physical rituals or mental rituals in the attempt to bring down the anxiety, but it becomes ineffective and also very time-consuming.
Is that like washing your hands 10 times type thing?
Yeah, it can be. It can be a number of different kinds of rituals, but that is one of the mm-hmm. more common ones, certainly. Contamination fears.
Right.
Or concerns of illness that result in washing or cleansing or avoiding.
Mm-hmm.
To other things like trichotillomania or excoriation disorder, or what we call body-focused repetitive behaviors, which are behaviors that are carried out compulsively, which is sort of a feeling of being driven to engage in a behavior that is detrimental to the hair, skin, or nails. So
mm-hmm.
it's things like pulling hair or biting skin or picking at skin that then negatively affects them, not just their appearance or their body themselves, but also how they feel about themselves. To neurodevelopmental problems like ADHD or tic disorders, Tourette's disorder. So we treat a wide variety within
those right, right.
three families of problems.
Now, hoarding has come to light because, you know, they have TV shows about it and everything else. Has it always been considered a disorder, or is it because of the publicity it's received because of the TV shows, etc.?
Hunting has been talked about in the literature for a very long time, but it hasn't been given it a specific diagnosis in our diagnostic manual until this latest edition of our diagnostic manual, which was published in 2014. So hoarding disorder is now a formal diagnosis, whereas it wasn't previously, and it falls under that obsessive compulsive and related disorders family.
Yeah, it's... I know someone who has a daughter who is a hoarder, and it's unbelievable. It really is, you know. I mean, it's like if you went into this person's apartment, it's like a little trail that goes around through it, and that's the only way you get through it because everything else is stacked up to the ceiling. And, you know, it just, you wonder, you know, like, is there, what do you do when you get a hoarder comes to you for help? How do you help them?
Hoarding can be quite a challenge.
I would think.
It's the level of insight that the individuals have who struggle with it are varied. And unlike a lot of other presenting problems, most of the time, individuals who struggle with hoarding are not the people actually making first contact with us. Typically, it's someone in the family who's concerned about them, or it's a housing authority, perhaps Child Protective Services. There's usually some other initial point of contact with someone that has problems with hoarding. Sometimes they have insight into it being a problem, but oftentimes they have limited insight, and so they're not typically the people that are coming to seek help.
Okay.
So that's kind of the first hurdle in getting them in the door. In terms of treatment, we help them to get insight into the struggles that they're having, and we help them learn skills to better manage the stuff that comes into their house, but also to better manage the items that they come in contact with every day, to help them find the cognitive processes that they're going through, or even the emotional processes that they're going through that lead them to either keep the item or take in the item or fail to discard the item or dispose of it or in a way that would be best for them. So, you know, we have to help them with skills acquisition.
Right. Now, would they not want to dispose of the item like a 10-year-old newspaper because they feel they may need something in it down a road, or is it just because it's something they don't want to get rid of?
It depends. It's really different for every person. It's very important when you see someone as a clinician who has this kind of difficulty, really any difficulty, but in talking with someone who struggles with hoarding in particular, it's very important for us to figure out the situation that surrounds the behavior itself. The behavior itself doesn't occur in a vacuum. You know, there are things that make it more likely. There are things that make it less likely.
Okay.
There are all sorts of different variables in each individual's lives, so we have to learn what that is in order to figure out, you know, what the behavior chain is, you know, what's happening right before they make that decision, what goes into that decision,
right,
what happens after they've made that decision. All of those things are kind of important factors. It may very well be that they have difficulty disposing of newspapers because they feel as though it may be useful to them one day, and so they want to keep it because they don't want to experience the anxiety related to the possibility of not having it and needing it later on.
Right.
It could also be something else. And so it's important for us to figure out for each individual what that is so that we can address it directly.
I would imagine it's very frustrating to try to get someone who has done this for a long period of time and has stuff stacked up to the ceiling in their home to get rid of any of it?
It depends. It really depends on the person. Some people, you know, are quite frustrated with having this struggle, and they want help with it. Mm-hmm. Other people, okay, not so much. Other people are very anxious about it and avoidant of it. It really depends on the person.
Right.
We always tell people that, you know, this is not something that develops overnight, and it's not something that we can help fix overnight either.
Okay.
It's a process. So, you know, it's something that they have to slowly learn to,
right,
deal with in a more effective, more adaptive way.
Okay. Yeah. It's just, you know, I find it, I won't say interesting, but because I know this lady whose daughter is a hoarder, and you know how it's, and you know so she tries and she goes to counseling and then, you know, falls off the wagon and starts doing it again, you know, and it's like, you know, back and forth, you know, which I suppose happens a lot of times. It's not just this, is that's just not that unusual, I would imagine.
No, it's not. The relapse rate is unfortunately decent. So, you know, when people learn these skills to handle these things differently, to keep it under control, it's really something that they then have to use, you know, for a, you know, indefinite amount of time.
It's right.
Something that they kind of have to often be on guard of, you know, like anybody else, and the things that they struggle with in their lives. Oftentimes, you know, it's something you kind of have to be mindful of, that you're, mm-hmm, vulnerable to,
right,
so that you don't fall back into, you know, quote-unquote old habits.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's not exactly the same thing, but I quit smoking about 28 years ago. And if someone lights up a Marlboro near me, I have to walk away. Because,
yeah, it's a great comparison.
I'd be very tempted to go back and smoke again, you know.
Right.
And it's just, you know, and it's only Marlboro because that's the one I smoked for most of my smoking years. But if, like I said, if somebody lights it up and I'm near there and I can smell it, I have to walk away. Because I know me. I've got this compulsive, you know, obsessive personality. That's why I don't go to Atlantic City too often, you know. But if I do, I leave my credit cards home and I make sure my car's got a full tank of gas, you know, and the tolls to go back and forth. But, you know,
yeah,
now,
I mean, we're creatures of reinforcement, whether we're talking about something with a clearly established, you know, neurochemical basis to it or not. I mean, our brains control what we do, and we are creatures of reinforcement. So when we establish these patterns, you know, they become things that our brains want to make happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So even over time, you know, we can still be vulnerable to it, even if it's no longer a pattern that we engage in.
Right, right. And like I said, I haven't smoked in 28 years, but, you know, don't light up a Marlboro near me, you know. But could you explain Tourette's and tic disorder and, like, the difference between them?
Sure. So tic disorders is a family of disorders that are neurological in nature. They are behaviors that are either motor movements or their vocal movements or sounds that people have limited control over. I say limited because they're not entirely involuntary. People experience usually a bodily tension or sensation in the part of the body where they have a tic. For example, a common motor tic is eye blinking, like a very hard eye blink. That's a common motor tic. And usually people will say that prior to engaging in that behavior, they feel a tension around the eyes, that they feel like they need to sort of discharge by engaging in the behavior. So it's this locally felt tension that is,
okay,
discharged by carrying out the behavior. They feel driven to do it in that sense. And then there are vocal tics as well. Motor tics and vocal tics together, at least two motor tics and at least one vocal tic, not necessarily at the same time, but persisting for at least a year, and established before the age of 18 is then Tourette's. So Tourette's is kind of a combination of vocal and motor tics over the course of time. It's considered a disorder of childhood in that it begins in childhood, but can persist through adulthood.
Is there, quote-unquote, a cure for Tourette's?
No, there is no cure, but there are certainly treatments. There are pharmacological means of treatment. There are medications that can be helpful if they're disruptive enough. Those medications, unfortunately, carry with them significant side effects, so typically they aren't prescribed unless the tics are very disruptive and they've already attempted the other less invasive treatments. The other treatment that is evidence-based is a therapy called Cognitive Behavioral Intervention for Tics. We call it CBIT, which also goes under the name Habit Reversal Training, or HRT. And that helps people to establish more adaptive, less disruptive patterns that involve, you know, the area of the body where they carry out the tic behavior.
Okay, when you say habit reversal training, you're saying that you try to get them to reverse what they're doing? Or am I not understanding that right?
It's an old term, which is why we call it now. We call it cognitive behavioral intervention for tics. But the old name for it really is habit reversal training. And it is kind of a misnomer. We're not reversing anything.
Okay.
What we're really helping them to do is to better understand the pattern of the behavior, what things make it more likely to occur, how that behavior is carried out in different situations, and the effects of that. And then, again, how that persists with each behavior that they have trouble with, each tic. And then what we do is help them to manipulate that in a way that makes their life more adaptive. So we'll do what we call competitive responses or competing response training, where we have them, for example, if they have a tic that involves loud throat clearing, let's say.
Okay.
Let's say this is a kid who's in school, and that loud throat clearing is disrupted in the classroom. But they feel as if there's a buildup of tension in their throat that they have to carry out a throat clear in order to release that tension and feel okay again. Then what we do is we look at that pattern of behavior, and we'll help them come up with a different kind of behavior utilizing those muscles, perhaps, that would not be quite as disruptive. So they're kind of replacing a more adaptive behavior for the tic.
Okay.
That makes sense. And when we have to practice that. So we're kind of manipulating the behavior a little bit because people do have a little control over it. We can also kind of manipulate the environment to hopefully make the tension less likely to build, or we can do things with the manipulating the stimuli in the environment as well to manipulate that pattern of behavior. So that's essentially what the behavior therapy involves.
Would the loud throat clearing, the example you provided, would that be considered the vocal or verbal tic disorder?
Tic, yes. Yes, that's a common vocal tic. So it could occur in itself as a tic disorder that just involves a vocal tic, or it could be part of Tourette's along with other tics, like other vocal tics, other motor tics.
Oh, okay. When you mentioned before, I'll call it hair pulling because trichotillomania.
That's excellent.
Oh, yes. I said it. All right. Whoa. I didn't think I was going to get that. Now, that's the body's focused on repetitive behaviors, correct? And
right. Trichotillomania is a specific kind of body-focused repetitive behaviors wherein people are driven to pluck hair.
Okay. And there's also nail biting. Now, if someone's biting their nails, does everybody who bite their nails have this problem?
Well, that begs the question. I don't think anybody really has an answer. You know,
okay.
What on the continuum of behavior, when does the behavior become quote unquote abnormal, right? We all engage in grooming behavior. At what point does that become, you know, quote unquote disordered or abnormal?
Right. Right.
I would argue that there is a wide range of normal behavior on the continuum. Everybody plucks hair at some point, right? But when does that become disordered? You know, according to our diagnostic manual, you know, the simple response would be, well, when it becomes to be an effect on someone's life, you know, when it becomes impairing in some realm of their life, does it become a problem?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, that what that is might be different for different people, right?
Right. Okay. It's just... Now, would cutting fall into that area?
Cutting doesn't fall in that. So cutting is a behavior that we classify differently under an umbrella we term as self-injurious behaviors. And it, those behaviors are carried out for different reasons that are more... I guess you could say emotionally involved and involve an attempt to modulate emotions, wider range of emotions,
mm-hmm.
whereas these body-focused repetitive behaviors, although oftentimes they are carried out to regulate emotional activation, for example, anxiety or boredom, but they're not typically used to regulate more difficult to manage emotions like, you know, anger
right.
or depression or those things, you know, problems with depression might also occur when you have a BFRB, but they're not intended to be harmful or to evoke, you know, pain at all. Unlike self-injurious behaviors, the BFRBs are really... carried out and are not experienced in that way. They, people who engage in BFRBs don't report them to be painful at all. They actually typically say they either don't hurt or they experience them as satisfying in some way or interesting at least in some way or perhaps even pleasurable in some way. That it's not intended to harm oneself at all.
Right. Ironically, I was... After I retired, I was asked if I would work one day a week at the local hospital, and they have a, for lack of a better term, a lockup ward. And I would mm-hmm. go there I would work the one day a week, and I would go there and talk to the clients there that were patients. And one day... After I got through talking to everybody, this one fella said to me, gee, would you mind speaking to me privately? I says, no, not at all. And so we went outside and, or, you know, into the lobby, like, and we talked, and we, you know, talked for quite a while. And all of a sudden he says, let me show you something. He took off his shirt, and there wasn't from his wrist to his shoulder on either arm a spot that wasn't scarred. From cutting. And I had never seen anything like it. I have known people who, you know, through NAMI, I've known people who had someone in their family or known someone who did cut, but never anything like this. I was flabbergasted. I mean, there wasn't a space on that young man's arm from his wrist to his shoulder on both sides, both arms, that didn't have... that wasn't cut. There wasn't a piece of skin that wasn't touched. And it was just unbelievable to me, you know. And I was I'm not at a loss for words often. And I was just lost for words. You know, I didn't know basically what to say to the young man. I mean, we continued talking and everything, and I convinced him to speak to someone, but... it's like, God, I couldn't believe it. You know, it's
yeah. I mean, I think it's a great illustration of the depth of some people's emotional struggles.
Right, right. And I just couldn't imagine, whether any of this that was, going on in his life was how much was real, how much was imagined. But I couldn't believe the amount of pain that must have been involved with him doing all this.
Right.
And how long you've been doing it.
I think you bring up something, right? The extent that people suffer is really the most important part of, mental health and mental health care. One thing that I say frequently is, even looking at a problem like schizophrenia, right, where people hallucinate and see things that aren't there, hear things that aren't there, right? People are frequently in a great deal of distress and are frightened of the voices or the things that they see, right? And, a lot of times people will get stuck on the fact that they're not real. But what's really important is that those things are real to them.
To them.
This is part
right.
of their real experience.
Right.
Whether or not other people see it or experience it is sort of unimportant. What we need to focus on is ways to alleviate those individuals' suffering.
Right.
It's good that that's not reality. However, they are in distress, and it is part of what they perceive as reality. And that's really what we need to focus on is, helping people to relieve their own suffering.
Right. And, my youngest son has schizophrenia and has for the last 19 years. And in the last, 16 of those 19 years have been pure hell. But now he has his own apartment. He religiously takes his meds. I think part of that has to do with the fact that he's been epileptic since he's 5 and he's been on medication since then. So it's like, that may have something to do with it. But the only thing he'll ask is, why are we switching it? Why are we increasing it? Why are we decreasing it? And, that sort of thing. But other than that, he'll take it religiously. And he has, for the last little over a year, he's had a job, part-time job at BJ's. And I don't know if you've ever been in any of these like Costco, BJ type stores, but
sure. If
you go into like BJ's, they'll be selling, people will be standing at a little cart and they'll say, "Ooh, would you like to try this cookie?" Blah, blah, blah. It's so many. Well, my son was so introverted most of his life that to think that he has this job where he sells stuff and talks to strangers, walking by and asking them to try the ice cream or the coffee or whatever he's pushing, is just to me unbelievable, and it's just, and he can control his mumbling to the voices while he's working. And he's come so far,
That's wonderful.
And, it's just, like I said, you try to tell people who have someone who has a mental health issue, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It may be a long tunnel, but there's a light at the end of it, some people think, they'll all be back and everything will be fine and they'll be 100% recovered. That may not be true, but if they're 80% recovered, that's 80% better than they were when they weren't, recovered at all, So, I just look at it as he's come so far, and others I have seen over the course of years working with NAMI and such that they've come a long way also. And I think it's wonderful that we have people like you and others who help these people, with the different training and, et cetera. So for that, I congratulate you and thank you.
Absolutely. I think, you know, that really, that story just highlights, I think, the value of having a family who's invested in helping their loved ones, you know, make the best of what they have. And, you know, the
right.
importance of having caregivers who can hopefully help them to make the most of, you know, the life that they can lead. Absolutely.
And sadly, not everybody who has an issue has support, you know, so.
Right, and I think that's one really great thing about organizations like NAMI, or, you know, any other advocacy organization.
Absolutely.
As well. There's some other really great organizations.
Yes, there are.
Talked about Tourette's. There's an organization called the New Jersey Center for Tourette Syndrome, which does a phenomenal job in providing support and education. OCD New Jersey as well is a
right.
great
right.
local New Jersey support network. So, I mean, support is out there. So even if families or individuals don't have a greater network of support in their communities, there are resources.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, and I think it's great that there are, you know. And I happen to know someone who's involved with the Tourette's Foundation thing there. And I think that's wonderful, you know. What, if you would mind telling me what, or not only me, but our audience and everybody, what is mindfulness training?
Mindfulness training is something that's kind of become, I want to say, sort of in vogue in recent years because it's been shown through research to be helpful to a lot of different kinds of people. Mindfulness training is helping people to learn to be present in the moment, essentially. You know, not be sort of stuck in their head. A lot of times, you know, we have this ongoing voice in our head that has us either worrying about what's happened or worrying about what's ahead and what we're going to do or analyzing what's going on. And it really just helps people to learn to be in the moment and take in every bit of what's happening presently through all of their different senses.
And is it difficult to get patients or clients to adhere to that?
Usually we use mindfulness. Everybody uses it, I think, a little bit differently if they use it. But the way that we use mindfulness training is as a component of different kinds of some evidence-based treatments that we do. So, for example, one of the kinds of cognitive behavioral therapies that we do is acceptance and commitment therapy. And another one that we do a bit of is dialectical behavior therapy. And mindfulness is a significant component of those treatments. Part of it is to help people kind of learn to slow down a little bit, to be in the moment, to not get wrapped up in what their mind is telling them, but to get a little bit of distance from the chatter of their mind and just be present in the moment, experiencing what it is they're experiencing now. It's work. It sounds like a very simplistic thing. It sounds silly, but it's really actually quite challenging.
Mm-hmm. What was the first one you said?
Acceptance and commitment therapy.
Acceptance and commitment therapy, okay.
Right. It's often referred to as ACT.
Okay. All right. That's probably why, you know, acronyms, I love them. Not really. I hate them. But, real quickly, I on a mental health board in Hunterdon County, and they gave us two and a half, three inch thick booklet of all the acronyms, you know. I'm saying, you people crazy? Well, you think I'm going to remember all these? You know, but no, I have heard of ACT, and I just didn't associate it with what, you know, you were saying. Now, when someone reaches out either to your organization or is referred to your organization by, you know, someone or medical doctor or whatever. What is the process for them? I know you have a two centers, Cherry Hill and Princeton, and I know that you have a, you know, a quite an adequate staff in both of them. So what is the what would be the process, say, for someone who reaches out or is referred to you?
So oftentimes people wind up visiting our site to kind of check out what we offer and the kinds of problems that we treat. And they can give our office a call. We have a clinical coordinator who takes calls throughout the day. And then she can help them by answering their questions or scheduling an appointment, explaining the different kinds of levels of care that we offer. We are outpatient facilities, so we're not residential.
Okay.
Although, you know, people typically come in for treatment once a week. However, we do see some people more intensively. We do some what is referred to as intensive outpatient. Mm-hmm. Therapy, where we see people a bit more frequently during the week because of the level of difficulty they're having, and then we step it down as they get better.
Mm-hmm.
But we also offer different levels of services because several of us come from academic backgrounds, and so we have a training clinic within our clinic. So people have the option of seeing a licensed psychologist who has years of experience in treating these kinds of presenting problems, but then we also have people under supervision learning to do these kinds of treatments. So we have postdoctoral fellows, and we also have doctoral students here as well who are
right.
learning these things under supervision. So there are a lot of different options as to who they see and when.
Does both the Princeton and Cherry Hill centers treat the same disorders, or do they specialize, one specializes in another, or how does that work?
No, we actually do. We treat the same families of problems in both settings, and actually our staff travels between the two. So,
oh, okay.
As of now, we still don't have a clinician that works at only one place. We like people to be familiar with both offices, so they're plugged into both communities here. So the same doctors at Cherry Hill are the same doctors in Princeton.
Okay. Well, that's not bad, you know, when you think
it's
about
really
it.
It's really great, and it's great for our environment as clinicians. It's good for us as a group as well.
Right, right. Do you take Medicare or Medicaid or anything like that?
No, we don't. Unfortunately, we don't. We opt out of Medicare, so we don't provide services to those individuals unless they would like to make an agreement with us outside of that. We are permitted to make those arrangements, but we don't
okay.
Participate with Medicare. We do take some private insurance.
Okay.
And then we offer, for those insurance carriers that we don't accept, we do have those various levels of clinicians
mm-hmm.
so that people have an option in terms of how, you know, expensive or inexpensive their
right.
services
right.
will be.
In the last, let's say, 4 or 5 minutes, is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to cover? I'm putting you on the spot here.
I would really want to plug the fact that there are a lot of community resources. I imagine that your listeners are probably particularly interested in that because they're aware of NAMI and probably pretty educated in what NAMI can offer people. You know, outside of what I do every day in my job, I'm also involved in a lot of different community health nonprofit organizations, and I think that those kinds of organizations like NAMI are really valuable. So I think it's really important for people to be aware of those resources. Many of them are free, if they're not free, they're at very minimal membership dues. And organizations like that, like the New Jersey Center for Tourette Syndrome, like OCDNJ or mm-hmm. the International Foundation for OCD, like the TLC Foundation for Body-Focused Repetitive Behaviors, you know, those kinds of advocacy organizations provide a great deal of information and support networks for people who simply don't have it or perhaps find services inaccessible. You know, sometimes you can, if you can't find specialized service in your area, you can call an advocacy group like that, and they are very familiar and very right. well-versed with, you know, who is particularly skilled at providing certain services. So it's great to call them up and say, hey, you know, what resources are available to me? I live in this town here.
Right,
So I, you know, I think it's very important to be tapped into community resources like that.
Well, in Hunterdon County, where we are, we do that. We get full calls like that all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have people that we can refer them to and, you know, so on and so forth. And, you know, some people don't mind traveling, you know, so we can refer them outside of the county, you know. But some people just want to stay within, or they don't have transportation, so they want to stay within. But I think, like all the organizations you named, they're outstanding, you know. And I personally think there should be more organizations that are doing the work that, pardon me, that we're all doing, so we can help more people. And that's what it's all about, you know, is helping people. You know,
absolutely. We need to figure out how to eliminate the need for sleep so that those of us who are interested in doing that kind of work have more time available to do it.
Exactly. Exactly. Would you give the phone number and the website
you
know, for your organization?
Sure. Our website is www.thecenterforemotionalhealth.com, and our phone number is 856-220-9672.
Okay, 856-220-9672.
Right.
Okay, and the website again was www.
TheCenterForEmotionalHealth.com.
And do you find that your clients come mostly by referral, or they just reach out to you, or that's just a curious question of, you know,
yeah,
my curiosity.
It varies. We get a fair number of referrals from other doctors in the community
mm-hmm.
and other specialized treatment centers in the area, as well as some specialized residential programs around the country. If they happen to live in this area and they get discharged back home, they want to make sure that they have outpatient care at home that is consistent with the care that they were receiving in those programs. So
right.
we get referrals from there. We also, you know, the internet is a wonderful thing, and people have the ability to get on and search for all sorts of stuff and figure out on their own or with some guidance of other providers, you know, what they need. And some people will come upon us on their own, you know, having an idea of, you know, I need, you know, this kind of treatment for this kind of problem. Or so sometimes people happen upon us just by, you know, Googling us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I will say you have an awesome website.
Advocacy organizations.
I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Sorry. Sometimes also from the advocacy organizations, we do a lot of volunteer work as well. So sometimes through those organizations, too. But thank you for the website compliment.
No, I've been on it, and, you know, in fact, last week. And I just think it's an awesome website. I really do, you know. It's very informative and very, you know, It gives a list of, you know, your associates and such. And, you know, I just think it's a very good website, you know.
Thanks. I think patients should be informed. You know, if you don't know where your therapist or, you know, any of your treaters, whether it's your physician or your psychologist or, you know, your social worker, I think everyone should be informed of, you know, what their training is, what their background is.
Right.
You know, what they know about the specific problem that you're coming to with. So I feel like it's our responsibility as providers
right.
to provide our patients with that information.
And well, I think you've done a great job. And I mean that sincerely.
Thank you.
Dr. Deibler, I can't thank you enough for being on. And I really want to have you back again because I think that what you're doing is awesome. You're helping people and, you know, and you have two centers and, you know, I just think it's wonderful. I really do. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. And remember, folks, the phone number is 856-220-9672. Correct?
It is. Thank okay. you so much for having me, and thank you for what you do. This is also a very important community service.
Well, thank you so much, and I will be reaching out to you again yeah, to see if we can't come up with another day where you can come on, because I really think that it's awesome and what you do and everything. So I really appreciate it. And this is Dr. Marla Deibler, and it's founder and executive director of the Center for Emotional Health of Greater Philadelphia, and it's in Cherry Hill and also in Princeton, New Jersey. And the phone number is 856-220-9672. And look on the website, which was
www.thecenterforemotionalhealth.com.
Thank you again, Dr. Deibler. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
And have a good rest of the week and enjoy the rest of the summer. And remember, folks, mental health really does matter. Take care. See you next week, same time, same station.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Home Instead Senior Care. It's our passionate dedication to creating personal relationships between our clients and our caregivers. Visit our website at www.homeinstead.com/325.
You've got a friend.
USA Radio News, I'm Jason Wirt. Donald Trump says the rich are going to pay their fair share in taxes, but he wants to get the government off the backs of business owners.
The rich will pay their fair share, but no one will pay so much that it destroys jobs or undermines our ability as a nation to compete.
A breakaway faction of the Taliban has claimed responsibility for a suicide attack on a hospital in Pakistan that has left 67 people dead. A spokesman for the group said the attackers killed the head of the local bar association, then turned to target the mourners who had gathered at the government-run civil hospital. The group's been behind several attacks of terrorism in Pakistan in recent years. And if you're one of the many millions of Americans who enjoys free TV episodes on the website Hulu, you're going to be upset. They're taking the free episodes away. The website says they are working on changes to make them more like an online cable TV provider. USA Radio News, I'm Jason Wirt.
Hello, it's Angie from Daybreak USA, and I have fabulous hair. I do now. It used to break off when I brushed it. It fell right on the floor. But I have a solution for you if you have the same problem. Cell Therapy by Ovation, a unique breakthrough treatment found in no other hair care line. Here's how it works. Cell Therapy Breakthrough Formula, it nourishes the hair and scalp for hair that is noticeably thicker, stronger, longer, and healthier looking. It really is. Here's the deal. I used to have split ends, and it was dry and brittle, and it's finally gotten long and thick. It really does work. They offer a 365-day money-back guarantee, a statement of confidence, again, found with no other hair care product. Seriously.